Hi, I'm Keegan.
And I'm Madigan.
And you're listening to
Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist. This is a podcast where we explore the world through our own personal feminist perspective.
All righty. Hello, Madigan.
Hello, Keegan.
How are you today?
I'm super tired and had a really bad headache. I went to bed after 1 and woke up at like 6:30. And then
why?
I think Penny woke up. Oh, there was a super loud squirrel in our tree right outside the window. So she was like trying to figure out what was going on with this loud squirrel. And we were kind of just like watching it together. And then after that, I was just like, I'm up now, you know?
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's also been so hot, which I feel like is disturbing our sleep patterns.
Yeah.
You know, like totally. Not last night, but the night before, I woke up in the middle of the night, like sweating. It was like 3 a.m. and we had the AC on. We turned it up while we went to bed, but still, like, it was just that hot.
Oh yeah. Yesterday when I was home, I didn't, like, yesterday was the day that I was gonna like compile all my notes together. I write during the week in like multiple notebooks, and then I type everything up on Saturday, and I didn't do any of it because every time I sat down to like work, it was, even with the AC on me, it was so hot and unbearable. I was just like, there's no way I can do this. I was like, I'm just gonna get up. And I wanted to get up early in the morning anyway so I could do it. And then I was done by like 10. So then I just kind of like, I took a nap eventually and just kind of tried to rest a little bit. So I'm feeling better right now, but it kind of feels like it's like 4 in the afternoon already. And it's only like 12:30 here.
Yeah, I hear you on that.
I'm
for sure.
Very and thrown I'm off sure today.
The rest of the country is experiencing heat as well. At least that's from what I see, like, in my weather app. I always check like Missouri's weather, and it's been hot everywhere. But for listeners who are not in Los Angeles right now, we are having a heat wave. For the next week, it's going to be in the hundreds or upper 90s. So
I know. Even my dogs are just like aware that they should not exert any extra energy. Like, neither of them moved until the sun went down last night. They were just like, no, mama.
Dude,
we're just gonna lay down.
I know what they mean, but I've been on this new workout program, so I've been working out every day, and today is my rest day, and I was gonna go on a walk. And I'm like, I can't go on a walk. It's too hot. I have to find something else to do that's kind of like semi-active in my house. We do need to jump into this episode because it is likely to be a long one.
Yes. Well, luckily we both have our white claws. We're ready.
We do. I found this to be kind of a difficult episode to prep for.
Right.
Because you're having to do kind of like background on two different people and be in depth enough to get to know who they are while also being concise enough to know that we have to try and get all of this in an hour. So it was a little hard for me. I have like 10 pages of notes and like 18,000 sources. But
And that's good. And that's the thing, is that there are times also where I feel like I have too much information, and I kind of condensed everything down for myself today just for the things that I feel like are closest to the things that we want to talk about and reasons why we're struggling with you know, this team, but also just, again, talk about who they are as people a little bit, what their past is like, and also just really discuss how we're feeling about it. And we're going to be discussing Joe Biden and Kamala Harris for the next few months quite heavily, because there's going to be, I'm sure, lots of news headlines involving them. So it is going to kind of be an ongoing thing, but especially now that Joe Biden has officially announced his running mate to be Kamala Harris, I felt that it was important for us to get to know them, especially because, of course, immediately, you know, Trump's team points out speculation about, like, if she's an actual American citizen.
Oh, yeah. They started the birtherism stuff back up hardcore immediately because they're racist.
And then there's also, on the other side, there's people who I feel like don't want to talk about the shortcomings of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, where we still need to remember them. And the reason that it's important to remind ourselves and each other of their shortcomings is because if they do become our president and vice president, these problems that are going on in our country aren't going to go away. We still have to protest for them. We still have to fight for them and hope that these new leaders will listen to us enough to comply. And unfortunately, especially when it comes to their history with law enforcement, it's unsettling for us.
Yes. So That's exactly right. I mean, and it does, we do need to keep in mind that these people are, one, human beings, so they are complex.
And their politicians.
Thoughts and opinions do change over time, but they are politicians, and that's something that's really important to remember. I feel like there are certain politicians, especially Obama, comes to mind right away, who we tend to idealize and only remember the positive things about them, but they are still politicians. Obama had a lot of things that he did while in office that I disagree with. If we were putting his policies under a microscope the way that we are now doing with Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, we would also have very critical things to say, especially
that would actually be a really great episode idea to look back on some past like presidencies and see what was good and bad in them and what in line with our views now and things like that.
Because honestly, in some ways, Obama's stance on crime and being, quote, like hard on crime and all of those things was almost, he was almost more radical in that way than Kamala was. Because, for instance, and we're going to talk about this later, like Kamala was very staunchly and continues to be very staunchly anti-death penalty, whereas Obama was very pro-death penalty and actually considered himself to be tougher on crime than John Kerry. So there's anytime, I say all that only to say that anytime you look at candidates, especially ones like Joe Biden, who have had a very long career, you are going to find things that you do not like. But it is important to talk about those things and also to see if we believe the candidates have really grown or if they are pandering to us, you know, like it's
exactly
just, it's one of those things that we felt we needed to talk about. Joseph Robinette Biden Jr.,
which he was. I love the middle name Robinette.
I wonder where it comes from because he is a junior. So his father was Joseph Robinette Biden Sr. I wonder if Robinette was maybe like a maiden name or a family name that was turned into a middle name.
Have a teacher by that last name? When you went to school? Okay, so I did, and he was one of my favorite teachers. So that might be also why I love that name, but I've always loved the name Robin, too. So Robinette, to me, just sounds really
cool. I actually think Robinette as a first name for a girl would be really cute.
Oh, my gosh. It's very cute. There's so many cute girl names and no cute boy names in the world. Like, I'm screwed if I have a boy. He's going to just be called Baby Boy.
Baby Boy.
Or Baby Gender Undecided until you're older, and you can tell me how you identify. It's a really long name.
He was born in 1942 on November 20th, 1942.
Sorry that old. I keep interrupting you, but like 1942, could we think about that for a second?
He's like my grandpa's age. Like that's how old my grandpa is.
For real. I mean, it's insane.
Yeah, it's insane. So, I mean, again, he will be the oldest president in history if elected, and Trump is old as shit, so that should tell you something. But he was born in Scranton, Pennsylvania, which, as somebody who watched The Office, I love that, you know. I also love that his mom's name is Catherine Eugenia Biden, but she went by Jean. Eugenia, I just think it's such a cute name.
I love old names, too. I know that's not the point of this episode, but I love old names.
So do I. But his childhood seems pretty standard 1950s, 1960s white America to me. So
yeah, very middle class suburb, you know, good, healthy upbringing, good parents.
Yeah, I mean, what I will say is that they did go through some difficult times. So while his father had been wealthy before he was born, after he was born, he fell on hard times. And the entire family ended up moving in with his mother's parents for a while, the Finnegans. So they lived with his mother's parents for a while, but eventually they ended up moving to Delaware, where his father got a job as a used car salesman, and they then kind of had this, what seemed to me, this kind of Leave It to Beaver middle
class.
Yeah,
that's what I was going to say. Very Leave It to Beaver kind of
lifestyle.
Like
he was a star football player, you know?
Yeah, he seems just exactly what you would think of, you know, a white. I picture him being kind of like, well, yeah, you said football, very jock esque.
Oh, very, probably very much.
Charming and popular. You know, just how all politicians are. Yeah. Yes. You know, I'm sure he had his way with the ladies. He was smooth, I bet. You know, all that kind of stuff. For sure.
And you see that still with him.
As, I mean, he tries to have his way with the ladies. We could say that.
Right. But he still has this charm.
Yeah.
You know, I think he has this charm, even though, yes, now in our current climate, sometimes that comes across as a little like, ooh, like too creepy. But I bet you at the time, I bet you he was incredibly charming. He was good looking. He was this all-star athlete.
Yeah.
So he graduated high school in 1961, and then he went to the University of Delaware, where he double majored in history and political science. And while he was there, he met his first wife. And I had to look up how to say this.
I think Nelia. It's, yeah, Nelia. Because it's like Neil and then Ia. Mm-hmm. Nelia Hunter.
I kept wanting to say Nelia. But I think it's Nelia Hunter.
Yeah. Then he went and got a law degree from Syracuse in 1968. And they didn't. Did they say on any of the websites what year he got married to Nelia?
They did. It was in like 1966 or something.
Right. So he got his law degree and he briefly worked as an attorney in Delaware before quickly switching to politics.
I found it really interesting during this period, the similarities between Trump and Biden. And
I don't
say that to mean like that they're the same. They're not. But Biden was not drafted to Vietnam because he had draft deferments while in school. And then ultimately, he ended up being exempt from service because of his asthma, which Trump was exempt from service because of his bone spurs, which asthma does seem more legit.
What are bone spurs?
It's something in your foot. Like it's like I don't know. It's like a thing in your foot. And so Trump was exempt from service because he had bone spurs. It's just interesting to me that both of them, neither one of them went to Vietnam. And then similarly to Trump, Biden is a teetotaler. I can never say that, which is basically like he is sober. So alcoholism was prominent in both Trump's family. His father was an alcoholic. I think his uncle actually died from alcoholism. Maybe not his father. His uncle died from alcoholism. And then...
Yeah, I'm looking forward to reading the book about his life that I think... What was it? His sister?
His niece.
In-law, sister wrote? Talking I think about his niece that. Oh, his niece. Yeah. Goes into a lot of that family history from the excerpts that I've read, and it's very interesting.
Yeah. And so similarly, the Biden Finnegan families, they both had alcoholism in their families as well. So both men abstained from drinking alcohol. Like from, they just don't, neither one of them drink.
I had no idea that Trump was sober.
Yeah. Which I just find that, well, I mean, he doesn't drink, but a lot of people are like, he takes Adderall. Like he's on uppers.
Yeah. We know that Trump would possibly like his drugs quite a bit.
Yeah.
What I've heard, you know?
Biden also got a lot of flack for not participating in anti-Vietnam War protests. Later on, people would give him a lot of flack for that. And he was quoted as saying, "I'm not big on flak jackets and tie-dye shirts. Other people marched. I ran for office, got elected to the United States Senate at 29 and came down here and was one of those votes that helped stop the war." So he believes, like, I didn't need to march in the streets. I did the shit on the Hill.
What do you feel when you read that? Like, what do you think of that?
I mean, I think that the revolution has many lanes and marching isn't for everybody. And so I try not to be too critical of that. I don't like, he has this very, it's the thing that makes him appealing to conservative people now, conservative white people, older white people now, which is that he has this kind of moderate to conservative mentality about, quote, like hippie culture and things like that. Like,
right.
I don't like that he says, "I'm not big on flak jackets and tie-dye shirts," as if that's like, it feels like a dig to me.
Right.
Which I don't love.
Right. My issue, I guess, is just kind of having hindsight as to the things that he's to say in years to come about his activism. His non-existent, street activism that he talks about so much.
Yes.
So to me, when I hear that, that's just more evidence of the fact that he's lied to us a lot about the things that he's done.
Right.
And I say lie loosely because, yes, he was elected to an office where he could make real change and it's according to him, he did. But at the same time, it sounds very dismissive of the people getting things done. And then later on in life, trying to pretend that you were one of those people that you once kind of neglected, you know, and turned mm-hmm. away from.
I would say that was something in doing prep for this episode. So kind of spoiler alert of my final thoughts on everything. I will say doing prep for this episode made me soften on Kamala a little bit and made me a little bit more critical of Biden, actually, because of things like that. Like, throughout his career, he has kind of inflated things, manufactured things, exaggerated his participation in certain things. And the civil rights movement is one of those things. Like, he said over and over again that he marched in the civil rights movement, and that's really not true.
It's not. I watched a video this morning that was kind of going into all of the different, quotes of things that he had said at that time and how he had kind of like gone back on what he had said. I watched this great YouTube video where they kind of like compiled all of the times that Biden mentioned marching in the civil rights movement. And it's just like clip after clip. When I marched in the civil rights movement, when I marched in the civil rights movement. And this is in like 1987, during his first two tries to run for presidency. We heard this a lot. He said he participated in sit-ins at lunch counters when he was 17 in Wilmington, and he would go to like the black churches and congregate to help like desegregate movie theaters and, you know, help with vote, you know, sign up people to vote and all this stuff. So he's said all of these things, and I should have a link to this video because it's done very, very well. And then literally a few months later, when he dropped out of one of the presidential races, he says, during the 60s, I was in fact very concerned about the civil rights movement. I was not an activist. I worked at an all-black swimming pool in the east side of Wilmington, Delaware. I was involved. I was involved in what they were thinking, what they were feeling.
Make you.
And then he says,
I mean, you did anything.
And then he says again, I was involved, but I was not out marching. I was not down in Selma. I was not anywhere else. And he describes himself as being a suburbanite kid who got some exposure to what was happening to the black Americans in his city, which is good enough. It's good enough to like to say, like to give your actual experience of connecting with, if it's true that you felt during that time that you felt an education from those in the black community in your city and in your area, then that should be good enough. You don't have to pretend that you were some amazing activist, because we can fact check that shit.
Well, and also don't frame being exposed to black people as any kind of activism. That's
exactly.
Not activism. Like it's a great point. It annoys me that he says I was involved because I was a lifeguard at a black swimming pool. That
I was surrounded by them. Yeah.
Yeah. That doesn't mean you did anything. If you were exposed to things and you didn't actively work to stop anything, then that actually makes you worse mm-hmm. than people who were not exposed to black communities and didn't do anything. So
exactly.
That annoys me. I don't like that part of this. And that's something about Joe Biden that annoys me just in general about him, because I feel like he tries to figure out what the pulse is and then tries to make himself fit into whatever that is.
And which is a positive and a negative. Like, in a way, if you're looking at it from the game of politics, it's a positive, because then that means that he might actually listen to what the people are saying, because that's going to be what's the most popular. But
it means I can't trust him, though, because
you can't
the second
trust
the tide
him,
turns.
Because this is the thing. When he started his campaign with Obama, he started those lies up again. He started talking about marching. He started talking about being an activist again and making these same claims, when literally he had said, you know, just what was it like at the time, less than 20 years earlier, that wasn't true. He talks about how he got his education for real, he says, in a black church. He goes, that's not a hyperbole. And it's like, you literally have... We have it. We have the receipts of you saying years ago that you were not fully involved. You were involved in this weird way in your head because you were surrounded by the black community in some way, but you did not get your education in a black church. That's just such
right.
bullshit to me.
Right. And we'll have lots more to talk about with that. So I'm going to keep talking kind of like through him becoming a senator. And
We will circle back.
Don't worry. So Nelia and Joe, they ended up having three kids, and he told his wife very early on, I think on one of their first dates, that he had ambitions to become a senator by the age of 30, and then he wanted to become president later on. So early in his political career, he clerked for a Republican named William Prickett. And at that time, he said he believed himself to be a Republican during this period. However, he disliked the Republican presidential candidate Richard Nixon so much that he ended up registering at that time as an independent. So he never registered as a Republican.
That's really funny, actually. And I think that, you know, that's the interesting thing about our political party system, which, again, I could go on tangents about that for days. But it's interesting how before, you know, the Trump presidency, you know, there were people that would kind of choose their candidate based on just what they believed rather than just choosing, you know, party or die kind of situations. Mm-hmm. Like, especially right. in the Midwest, I'm sure you knew a lot of people where it was just kind of on a candidate basis.
Yeah, candidate by candidate basis, a little bit more, because we weren't in such a culture where we weren't so polarized before, you know, and I don't really know enough about that to know whether or not that was good or bad, you know, really. Right. Like, I mean, of course, it was better that we weren't as polarized. But also, I feel like there was this kind of, to me, even now, Joe Biden represents this kind of like respectability politics.
Uh-huh.
Right. And he will go on, and we'll talk about that, to brag about the way that he was able to work with Republicans and segregationists and things like that throughout his career. And I don't know if that's good or bad.
Oh,
you know, like, it's good that he can work with these people.
Some of this shit is really bad. Like, one of the guys that he worked with in Senate, which we'll get to, is a piece of shit. So
absolutely.
You want to move us a little bit more forward, Keeks?
Yes. So in 1969, he began practicing law as a public defender, and that law firm was headed by an active Democrat, and that's the person who actually got him interested in the Democratic Party. And so later that year, he ran as a Democrat to represent the 4th District on the Newcastle County Council with a liberal platform that included support for public housing in the suburban area, and he won by 2,000 votes in what was usually a Republican district. So here is a benefit. I don't want it to be just all shitting on Joe Biden.
Right.
Because I will say that from the beginning, he had some very progressive ideas. The idea that from the very beginning, you know, before he was even 30, he had a platform that supported public housing, and that he was able, there is something to be said about his ability to reach across the aisle and get Republicans who normally would not vote for a Democrat to vote for him. And I think that that is something that
that's a likability factor, I think, too. He does have a very, you know, and we just mentioned, you know, some similarities to Trump. And obviously he is not Donald Trump. But, you know, there is something about him being, you know, a middle-aged white man, having grown up, you know, kind of in white suburbia, that kind of thing, where I feel like he can still connect with that walk of life a little bit better than maybe some of the other candidates. Like, if you look at Bernie and you look at Biden, the way that they would relate to differences is completely, is you can't compare the two. You know what I mean? He's just a very different type of politician that wants to meet halfway almost, you know?
It's really hard because the things that I like about Bernie is that he's like, this is right, this is wrong, it's black and white, and if you don't believe in these things, then you're fucking wrong.
Exactly.
And I appreciate that, because to me, that's how I see it. And Joe Biden is very much more what I would consider to be kind of like lukewarm or wishy-washy, and I don't like that, but that kind of being able to compromise thing, it appeals to a certain section of the population that we do need to vote for Democrats in this election. So I get it. I get why people are supportive of him.
And I get, and I just want to say, now that it's brought up, that I completely understand why he's our nominee right now. You know, there's a lot of talk about whether he's the candidate that we kind of need right now as someone who can kind of reach across the aisle. Of course, we would have had somebody else in mind. But, you know, it's one of the, that's been a real topic of conversation at my house lately, whether or not he's the candidate we need at this time to be able to kind of work with the Republican Party to kind of lessen up on some of their craziness. Well,
you know, we could argue all day about whether or not he's the candidate we need, but you know what? He's the candidate we got.
It's the candidate we got, exactly. So I guess there's really no saying. Yeah. There's no arguing. We're just stuck either way.
But Biden ran for U.S. Senate in Delaware in 1972, and his campaign had almost no money. Again, like, he has this ability to be charming, and part of that was that he was very good-looking, had a very good-looking wife and appealing young family, yeah. You know. And the person he was running against was this, like, aging, you know, senator. So he ran. He was not expected to win. His campaign did focus on withdrawal from Vietnam, the environment, civil rights, mass transit, more equitable taxation, healthcare, the public's dissatisfaction with politics as usual, and just quote unquote change, which I included that because I feel like that's still something he does, and that's something that a lot of politicians do, where they're like, vote for change.
Vote for change, yeah. And you're like,
okay, but what does that mean?
Yeah, what's the change? Exactly. I had written that he also focused on criminal justice and drug policy in his first Senate campaign as well. So I think that's
kind of... That may be true.
Yeah,
I may have read a different article, but...
You know what? I don't know if this one was Wikipedia or Britannica from that exact one, so I don't know. Well... This is kind of, I'm going to bring it down for a second because this is really sad. But a few months he was elected to Senate, his wife and infant daughter were killed in a car accident and his two sons were badly injured. It's just so sad. So, I didn't know this.
Yes, I learned it semi-recently. I mean, his life is actually full of quite a bit of tragedy.
Yes.
So he had just been elected into the Senate. It was like a few weeks after the election.
Yeah.
And his one-year-old daughter was killed as well as his wife. And then while they were Christmas shopping, like it was in December, December 18th. And then his sons, Beau and Hunter, they survived, but they were wounded. So Beau had a broken leg and Hunter had a minor skull fracture and other head injuries. And then for the rest of his political career, in remembrance of his wife and daughter, Biden to this day does not work on December 18th on the anniversary of the accident. And can you imagine, like, he's 30. He's one of the youngest senators ever to be elected.
That is so young.
Is crazy, crazy young. Yeah. And he just lost. He's now a single parent who just lost his wife and child. And he was going to quit. Like, he was like, I'm going to leave politics.
Yeah.
And go raise my kids. But he was convinced to stay in.
Yeah. So he was definitely encouraged to go on. And he would go on to marry Jill Jacobs in 1977. And they had a daughter together as well. And Jill is the one that we are used to seeing with him on the campaign trail. And in the White House,
and
his vice president.
Relationship as well.
They're like, very they sweet together. I obviously we know nothing about their relationship, but just from appearances, they're a great political couple from all intents and purposes.
He credited her with kind of like getting him back on track,
yeah.
And motivating him to be better. But I will say, like, he does seem like a very sweet husband and father. So when he was sworn into office on January 5th, 1973, again, only like less than a month, only weeks after losing his wife and daughter, he actually was sworn in his son Beau's hospital room. So it was televised from his son's hospital room.
Oh my gosh.
Because he didn't want to leave his son. So, he became the sixth youngest senator in U.S. history.
Yep.
And one of only 18 to take office before turning 31. So it's massive.
It's
it really
huge.
Is.
Yeah. I mean, he was definitely a go-getter and worked very hard. And I think, again, also had a lot of other personality traits going for him and was very likable. And that really supported him moving up in his career.
Yeah, I mean, and he did a lot of other things in his political career. Like you mentioned, he did run for president in 1987. He quit that race after he plagiarized bits of his speech from the British Labour Party leader Neil Kinnock. And again, this is what we're talking about. He, in this speech, falsely referred to ancestors of his who had worked in the coal mines, which wasn't true. And that's the thing with Joe Biden where you're like, why? Like, oh, you don't need to lie about these things.
Now, you, listeners, you know that I just finished watching Veep, so all of this political talk just brings me to that. But it reminds me of when there's a scene where the vice president, like, I don't know what she is at the time, but she takes someone's speech and it's like their personal private story about like their grandfather and stuff. And like, it's like, oh, well, you can't say this in your speech. You can't say this in your speech. And he's like, well, that's about my grandma. And she's like, I'm going to take it. It's a great story, you know? And yeah. It's like, it's in the moment. It's like, we want the audience to get, you know, amped up. We want people to connect with us, but then you forget that like, it's not your life. And people are able to call that shit out so easily.
That's absolutely. I mean, and I had read, and I left this out, but I had read that when he was in college, he was actually in trouble for having plagiarized something in one of his papers.
Joe.
And he said at that time when he was in college that that was a coincidence, that the, you know, similarities between his paper and this other person's paper were a coincidence. But it all got dredged back up in 1987 when he was running for president.
Of course it did.
People were like, you did this in college. You're doing it again now.
Oh.
It, that's the thing about Joe Biden. You're like, learn from your mistakes.
Exactly.
But again, there's so much more about his political career. We will touch on more of it. But I thought maybe now we can switch gears and talk a little bit about Kamala Harris's life. Do you want to?
Yeah, I'll start you off. So Kamala was born on October 20th, 1964 in Oakland, California.
What? I have so many family members in Oakland. That's where my...
Do you have hella family members in Oakland?
I do. I have hella family members in Oakland. My grandparents met and got married in Oakland, California. So we have deep Oakland roots.
Hella dope. All right. Let's go on. Let's hope we don't hear that too much if she's elected. So her mother emigrated from India in 1960 and her father emigrated from British Jamaica in 1961. And they met in Berkeley during different like civil rights events. And just to kind of give everybody some context, just because this is a California area that we're talking about, just to mention a bit what Berkeley is, especially in the 60s and 70s, it was like a very hip place for like liberals and open-minded people who wanted social change. So it was definitely typically a more welcoming area for the most part of California during that time. It was a bit more hippy-dippy. As some people
yeah, it
would
was
say.
More integrated. You know, there was a lot, it was a lot more culturally diverse than other areas. And Kamala actually goes on to say, you know, that while she was young, her parents would take her to civil rights marches and push her around in a stroller. But as she got older, I think her parents divorced when she was like seven.
She
or
was
so.
Seven when they divorced. Yeah.
Yeah. She ended up moving into a different area. And she and her sister actually had a really difficult time. She goes on to explain how they had a really hard time fitting in. A lot of kids didn't want to play with her because she was black.
I had read that when she would stay with her father in Palo Alto, it was a very different experience than being in Berkeley with her mom. And they did have to move to an area that's known as the Flatlands, which was a primarily black neighborhood that was a little bit outside of that, I guess, kind of nicer Berkeley area that we would think of. So yeah, after her parents divorced, it did sound like she was kind of separated from that environment a little bit. And then by the time she was in middle school, she and her sister actually moved to Canada. But going back to her life in school, because this is actually, I would say, a pretty important moment in her life and also in her political career. She was part of the desegregation program, which promoted busing. She was living, like I said, in the Flatlands, and she would be taken by bus to Northern Berkeley to go to Thousand Oaks School every day. And that school went from being 95% white to 40% black because of busing. So she was able to receive a better education in a more prosperous community thanks to the desegregation of buses. It's great.
So go ahead and put a bookmark right there.
Yep.
Because we will be talking more about that soon.
Exactly. Put a gold star on that bookmark.
Yeah, because we will be referring back to that shortly.
We are going to come back.
But she really seemed to embrace, while she was both Indian and black, and she attended both a black Baptist church and also a Hinduist church or temple.
She would go to temple, and she would actually visit her parents' hometowns a lot too. Like, she and her sister were very well traveled and knew where they were from. And I think that also creates another dimension to her that's really wonderful.
Right. So while she absolutely, completely continues to embrace her Indian heritage, like many biracial, half-Black people, she did self-identify as a Black woman and really spent a lot of time kind of becoming active in Black events, in Black committees, and things like that. So after high school, she attended Howard University, which is a historically Black university in Washington, D.C.
Yes, and she actually got in on kind of like a diversity scholarship as well. That's how she was able to go. So yes, she did kind of like get in touch with those roots a bit more. And I believe it was while she was at Howard University. Yeah, she was the president of the Black Law Students Association. So she was very involved.
Yeah. I mean, and she even says that, like, she had a very, very close relationship with her mother. But she has said many times that her mother took on the responsibility of raising two Black daughters. So they did identify that way very much as being Black kids.
Right. Well, and I think that, and this is something you can speak on, obviously, and I cannot, but I feel like with the friends that I have that are mixed race, most of the time, if their skin is on the darker complexion, they will identify as being Black. And yes. I wonder if that's just to make it easier also, you know, maybe on them and also to society to see them in one way instead of constantly having to explain your whole identity.
Well, I think, well, for me, at least, I can't speak for Kamala, right. But like for me, at least, like you... I didn't choose to identify as Black necessarily, because I feel like I get that all the time. I get questioned a lot about that. You are what the world treats you as.
Right.
So the world will never treat me as a white person. So I can't identify that way. I can tell people that I'm white, but I'm not. I mean, and I'm very clearly not. And so I wonder if that was part of it for Kamala. I also know that there is a lot of colorism in India. Even by Indian standards, even though we might look at Kamala and see, you know, her as being
lighter very clearly skinned.
Half Indian or half Black,
yeah.
and lighter skinned by African American standards, by Indian standards, she's probably still pretty dark, you know, dark skinned.
Yeah, and that so makes sense.
It may have been easier for her just to identify as a Black girl, especially in the 70s, you know.
Yeah, to me, it just seems like having multiple identities like that, which I know it shouldn't be necessarily, you know, you are one, you're whole, you don't have multiple identities, but I can imagine having to fit into multiple cultures at once would be really exhausting.
Yeah, it is. I mean, yeah, it is difficult. It is difficult. And I don't know what else, like, in her upbringing led her to kind of identify the way that she did.
Mm-hmm.
But I know for me, I didn't know, even though her name is Kamala, which is a Hindu name,
mm-hmm.
I didn't really know that she was half Indian until, like, this last year or so.
Yeah.
Like, I thought that she was a Black woman.
Very much so. Yeah, she appears to be that way. And I think what you said, it's not about how you identify as yourself. It's about how the world identifies you, specifically when it comes to race. I think that that makes a really good point that to me, it just seems like, you know what, if that's how you see me, it's just going to be easier if that's how I'm going to identify. And she did really hone in on that part of her identity.
Yeah. Well, I also think, you know, not to go on too long about this, but I also do think that it is partially the experiences that you have, right? So my understanding from reading about her childhood is that a lot of the discrimination she faced was anti-Black discrimination. And I think that that can shape your worldview as well.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you're facing a lot of anti-Black discrimination as a half-Black person, it will push you more to identify with that, I think.
Yeah.
Because people are pointing it out to you all the time.
That makes sense.
You know?
Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. So she...
So maybe that's it.
Yeah. She graduated from Howard University with a degree in political science and economics, which I'm like, okay, we got someone who knows economy stuff. That's good.
Yes,
right? She
absolutely.
Has a degree in economics. She got her law degree at the University of California. Oh, and it was there that she served as their Black law students, as the president of the Black Law Students Association. So it was not at Howard University. It was at University of California. And then she finally ran for district attorney in 2003, unless you have something you want to say in between that.
So she was admitted to the Bar Association in 1990. And then in that year, 1990, she was hired as a deputy district attorney in Alameda County, California, where she was noted as being an able prosecutor on the way up. And then in 1998, she campaigned against Proposition 21, which would have granted prosecutors the option of trying juvenile defenders in superior court rather than juvenile courts. So she was like, she actually did campaign against that, which is a really good thing.
Yeah.
And then, yes, in August of 2000, she took a job at San Francisco City Hall working for City Attorney Louise Renee. I'm not sure how you say her last name. But she ran the family, Kamala ran the Family and Children's Services Division representing child abuse and neglect cases. And we're going to say Renee.
She also did a lot of work with sexual assault cases. I read a lot about her work with, like, you know, the, what is it called? The three strikes rule law?
The three strike law. Yeah. Yes.
And, you know, ensuring that, you know, repeat offenders are being put away and things like that. But.
Right. But there are pros and cons with that three strike law. And I didn't get into a lot of detail about that. That might be something that we end up touching on later.
Right.
But I will say that Luis Renee, who was the city attorney, she did say before Harris became DA that she was going to make the best DA that the city had seen in years. So that's how people really, really admired Kamala. They thought she was very hardworking.
She was also supported by Senator Dianne Feinstein and Nancy Pelosi.
Yes.
So, like, so, she had good people in her corner for sure.
This woman, to quote Lin-Manuel Miranda, was nonstop. She just went. She was very single-minded in trying to move ahead, and that will be both a blessing and a curse as we move forward to kind of like look at her record.
A fun fact about her campaign in 2003 is that Chris Rock was on her campaign circuit.
Amazing.
Isn't that great?
That is great. But something I wanted to point out about her 2003 campaign for district attorney was that she pledged to never seek the death penalty. And that is a promise that she kept. And it was somewhat to the detriment of her career. And we will touch on why that was in a little bit.
Okay.
But she also said during her campaign that she would prosecute three strike offenders, but only in cases of violent felony. So she did put that caveat on there because there has been a lot that's been said about this three strike law being overly punitive, especially on people of color and especially in nonviolent cases. So she did put that kind of little asterisk next to her promise there. Mm-hmm. And she did end up winning with 56% of the vote, and she became California's first American district attorney of color.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool.
Very
and she
amazing.
Was sworn in on January 3rd, 2011 as the first African American and first Asian American and first woman to serve as California's Attorney General in 2011.
Yeah.
So I don't have a ton in between just because I was trying to like.
I do have a little bit of information really quick about her time as a DA. Her predecessor was really, really had a very low conviction rate. And when she was DA, her felony conviction rate before when her predecessor was there was 50%. And by 2009, it was at 76%.
Yes. So I have a whole section on her prosecution record.
Okay,
so
good.
We will for sure talk about that.
Okay, good. What do you want to get into now?
Well, I just wanted to say really quickly, so she became the attorney general in 2011, and she served as the attorney general until 2017, and then she was elected to the U.S. Senate in 2017, and that's where she remains to this day until hopefully November when she becomes our vice president.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. Well, what do you want to start talking about next?
Okay. So I have a few things here on Joe. So we've already kind of touched on his false civil rights claims. So unless you have anything else to say about that.
I just had one other thing. And stop me if you're going to mention this later, because I think you mentioned it earlier about working with certain other people. Like he worked with somebody named Senator James Eastland, which supported him with his like segregation of buses thing that is anti-desegregation.
Well, let's move into talking about Joe and the issue of busing and segregation.
Okay.
So if you want to kick us off with that, let's go there.
Sure. So Joe Biden opposed mandatory school busing. Even to this day, he argues that this is not an example of systemic racism, the fact that they had segregated buses, which makes no sense to me what kind of mental gymnastics he did to come to that.
And Kamala Harris disagrees
with him wholeheartedly.
And that's the thing that she kind of took him to task on earlier in the presidential race.
And that
that's
put
the thing
her
that
on
she,
the map, too.
It
like,
did.
That
yeah.
clip was everywhere. And you know what? So I watched that clip again this morning, but the title of it was about Tulsi Gabbard actually going after her. And so I watched the whole thing, and it really is... like, it almost kind of looks like a movie scene in a way. It's very, it's like somebody wrote it too well and it's perfect. Like what a debate scene should look like of candidates
and
tearing
look,
each other down.
I do not like Tulsi Gabbard. I really, really, really dislike her, but she made valid points.
She made real good points that Kamala could not argue. And that's the thing that I noticed
the
most.
After her prosecutorial record, which we will talk
yeah,
about.
Yeah, exactly. But Kamala did say, you know, when Joe Biden was talking about, again, mentioning his, like, you know, work with the civil rights movement and things like that, she mentioned that she wouldn't be standing on that stage for the debate that day if his bill had gone through and they had kept buses segregated. She wouldn't have gone to that different school. She wouldn't have gotten the education that she had. And she's very thankful for the fact that they desegregated the buses.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So to talk a little bit more about this, in 1975, there was a Senate hearing, and there was the legendary civil rights lawyer, Jack Greenberg. He said during the Senate hearing something to Joe Biden. So Greenberg was a longtime director of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and he took Biden to task for sponsoring a bill that would limit the power of courts to order school desegregation with busing. It was a move that followed the wishes of many of Biden's white constituents in Delaware. So Delaware is a fairly well-off state, a fairly white state, and his constituency did not want to have buses full of black and brown kids coming into their area to go to school. So it did, again, it feels like that very people-pleasy thing that Joe Biden does.
Yes.
Where he wanted to please the white people in his constituency. So his role in fighting student busing it was like 40 years ago that he did this, but it had renewed attention because of what Kamala kind of came out and said
exactly
during the debates. And he said that he strongly disagreed with Southerners' views, but he needed to work with them to get things done. But political experts later came out and said, and education policy researchers came out and said that although he was a supporter of civil rights in other arenas, he didn't simply compromise with segregationists.
He worked with them and partnered with them.
And he actually led the charge on the issue of busing that kept black students away from classrooms
exactly.
with white students.
So he was in cahoots with this guy named Senator James, I lost my page again, Senator James Eastland, who is just a blatant racist. He is called black people, the inferior race, like just a blatant racist. And there were letters that were uncovered shortly after this debate was aired or whatever. And it shows letters between the two of them where Biden is thanking Eastland for his support and another letter asking Eastland to help him put his bill before the Senate. So they did work together as partners to ensure that buses stayed separate.
And Biden would go on to defend this as saying, like, we had to reach across the aisle in order to get things done. This is what we had to do. But you didn't. The way that he talks about them and the way that he spoke to them felt very chummy in a way that makes me very uneasy as a black person.
Yeah.
Makes me feel uncomfortable. And again, if he had had his way, this, I don't see how you can look at this as anything other than discriminatory, the way that he
exactly.
felt about segregation. Essentially, he was pro-segregation in this one aspect.
And that is something that is mind-boggling to me, that more people aren't screaming from the rooftops constantly. You know, like, yes, that's huge. Even kids understand that. Like, kids who learn about, you know, Martin Luther King and Ruby Bridges, even if you were to say that to a child, would be like, oh, no, that's not good.
Right.
Obviously.
Yeah, exactly. He also has a history of sexual assault allegations. We would be remiss not to at least mention these. We've all seen the photos and videos of him just acting in ways that feel very creepy. Also, his behavior at Anita Hill's testimony for the Clarence Thomas confirmation. He didn't do enough, which is what he owns up to, that he didn't do enough to protect Anita Hill. But it goes beyond that. His questioning to her was also very, gosh, I don't know.
Invasive?
It made invasive, yeah, and unnecessary. And he kind of apologized to her, and Anita Hill did not accept that apology. So you know that it was something that really stuck with her, the way that he responded to her is just kind of a very vague misogyny that comes from a man of a certain age. That's what it feels like.
Yeah,
it's from Joe Biden.
Yeah, Max and I always just kind of refer to him as the creepy old man, you know, because I think, right, that's something that we can all picture really well. And a lot of people kind of just say that flippantly, like, oh, it's that generation. He's this creepy old man, which in a way is kind of true. It's like those people are going to die off eventually and that is kind of going to go away. But we still have to hold people accountable for their inappropriate contact.
Absolutely.
Especially in politics. If you're in the public eye, I feel that you have a responsibility to keep up with the times even more. You have to be on top of, like, what is acceptable and what is not, because look at this, all this shit's coming out now.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's kind of the thing about Joe Biden, and it's something that I've heard people on both sides kind of screaming about, like, why aren't you talking more about his inappropriate behavior with women? And then people on the other side kind of being like, it's not that bad. Again, it's just creepy uncle stuff, because most of it is creepy uncle stuff
is scary as hell. The right. fact that you're and saying uncle, a family member, has always creeped me out. And people say that, right, I'm like, no.
And that's kind of the thing, is like, it's hard to explain, but every woman knows what it feels like to be in a situation where they're just being made to feel uncomfortable by an older man. And
yeah,
it's not to say that it's out and out assault or rape, but it is uncomfortable. So, for instance, there was one woman in March 2020, former Senate aide Tara Reid, alleged that Biden sexually assaulted her when she worked for his office in 1993. Biden denies assaulting or harassing her. And there have been 8 women, including Reid, who have accused Biden of touching them inappropriately or invading their personal space in ways that made them feel uncomfortable. But all the women, so 7 of the women, all the women except for Reid, said that Biden's behavior did not amount to sexual harassment or assault. So again, as women, we know what they're talking about. So yes, it wasn't out and out assault or out and out, you know, aggressive harassment, but it's still something that makes women feel uncomfortable in,
yes,
the workplace, something we shouldn't have to go through, something that men don't have to go through.
Yeah.
You know,
well, and the talk about, you know, people asking, why aren't we talking about this more? And to me, we have 2 candidates who are sexual predators in some way, who are like creepy old men. They cancel each other out now. Like, we don't have to have that be a debate topic because they're equally as bad. We can't.
Well,
you know what I mean?
I would even say, though, they're not equally as
bad. Okay,
like, it's
they're
bad.
Not equally as bad. But I mean, like, you can't, like, Trump's team can't bring up the sexual assaults, because we could just say, well, yours are way fucking worse. You know what I mean?
Well,
like,
yeah, you have credible rape allegations.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, that's the difference. But I feel like that's why it's not being brought up as much. And it's simply because, like, I feel like people don't want to bring it up because the other candidate does as well, and they don't want to be dredging up more stuff. I don't know.
Right. I mean, and it sucks that we're in this position where it's like, okay, we have to choose between the lesser of 2 sexual harassers.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
Like, that's no fun.
And it's no fun. It's no fun for us to talk about. And that's the other thing, is we are fucking stuck with him with that kind of stuff. So if we're going to look at the lesser of 2 evils, he's like Aziz Ansari and Trump is like Harvey Weinstein.
There you go.
You know what
that's
I mean?
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's right. And not to downplay any of the things that he has done at all. That's not our intention, you know, but it's we had to talk about it. We had to at least bring it up. There's not a lot that's known about his sexual assaults or any of that stuff. We've all seen the pictures of him just being a little too
handsy,
friendly. Yeah, a little too
handsy.
And
I hate that. Like, all, like Keegan said, all of us know what that feels like. So we're not trying to downplay this at all or say that it's not a big deal. It's just one of those things that I feel like people don't mention it just because Trump is such a monster right. when it comes to yeah. it. They're like, why yeah. are we going to bring up Joe Biden stuff? But again, it's important that we do it because we have to hold him accountable. So if shit goes down while he's in office,
right.
that can't exactly. fly, you know?
Mm-hmm. So along the lines of holding people accountable for things, let's talk about Kamala's prosecution record.
Let's do it.
Real fast.
Yeah, it's so interesting.
It is interesting. You know, she kind of calls herself a progressive prosecutor, but her record... People have pointed to it and suggested kind of otherwise. Now, here's what I'm going to say before we go into talking about this is we're going to break down some of the things in her record that are really fucked up. We're also going to talk about I read an article in The Atlantic that was like an opinion piece that was basically arguing for all the reasons why we should cut Kamala Harris some slack.
Yeah.
On this stuff. So we will kind of talk about both sides of the coin here.
Awesome.
When talking about her record. So
yeah, well, and I wanted to make note really quick that there are many parallels between Biden and Kamala when it comes to their views on, you know, police brutality and mm-hmm. Law enforcement and things like that. So a lot of the things that we're going to be talking about with Kamala, I'm going to interject things here and there because Joe Biden was heavily responsible for the crime bill in 1994.
Yes.
Another thing that, you know, spearheaded mass incarceration and, you know, for the war on drugs and all of these things. And Kamala Harris just kind of came later on and still kind of, in a way, maintained a lot of those very similar views and enforced them. You know?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and again, I do urge our listeners to look at all of this through the lens of the 90s and early 2000s, which had a radically different view on crime.
Very like, different.
That was very much the law and order, tough on crime kind well, of like yes. era of politics.
Because in the like late 80s and 90s, the level of crime, like really violent crime, was again kind of skyrocketing. And again, with this whole war on drugs, there was all this panic about that kind of stuff. So Americans felt really, really scared and felt like we needed more officers in the streets to make us feel protected. And both Joe Biden and Kamala Harris has been quoted saying that people feel safer when there is someone in uniform walking down
right.
the street,
which
today
you know,
is not true.
We hear that now. Exactly. We hear that now and we're like, And even then, that's where I think, you know, kind of last week I said that skin folk ain't kin folk kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's where black people have an issue with Kamala Harris is that she says that and it feels very tone deaf to the black community because it's like, who feels safer?
Yeah.
Because it's not black communities that feel safer when they see, you know, more police officers on the street.
Yeah.
It's white communities that feel safer. And we'll talk a little bit about how or why that is that she would say something like that or even believe something like that. And it is to do with the politics of the time and her being an African-American woman.
Well, and I was going to say the other thing is that, you know, we think it's hard right now for a woman in politics in the 80s and 90s. I mean, if you know who Monica Lewinsky is and just how she was treated by the political world, you know, it was a very openly misogynistic time, especially
absolutely.
In politics. So to
absolutely.
So to get ahead, you kind of had to like be one of the guys and
yes,
play that
and
game.
So in that article, that Atlantic article that I was reading, it said, this is a quote from it, conventional wisdom held that being deemed pro-criminal was even more dangerous for black politicians. So for her, being a black woman, if she made any kind of move that was deemed to be soft on crime, she was judged exceedingly harshly for it. And it
right.
does point out that during his 2004 Senate run, Barack Obama bragged that as a state senator, he had passed 150 pieces of legislation that toughened penalties for violent criminals, which is something that we don't look kindly on now, but back then, especially for Black politicians, it was seen as something you had to appear to be on the side of white law and order and not on the side of quote unquote Black criminals.
Right. There's an interesting quote by this law professor named Laura Bazelon, and she says, in her career, Ms. Harris did not barter or trade to get support of more conservative law and order types. She gave it all away. And I was like, ooh. Like, she, yes, there was no like, you know, negotiations. And I understand why she did it in a way because, again, women are portrayed as being weaker. So we are softer on crime, weaker on crime, then that will take away the credibility of the person in office.
Right. And a Black woman in addition to that. And we'll talk a little bit about why she switched to being tougher on crime. So yeah. Let's kind of get into that as Attorney General real quick. So she was the Attorney General from 2011 to 2017, like we said. She refused to endorse a 2015 bill calling for special prosecutor to investigate deadly police shootings. This is something that we've that lots of people point to now.
Yes.
Because she supports Black Lives Matter now, but when she had the opportunity, she failed to endorse a bill that would have pushed to investigate deadly right. police shootings.
And she also would deny investigations if she was asked to like help and service mm-hmm. an investigation on a police shooting.
Right.
She would be very flaky, maybe not respond or just say that she was unable to help. And right. especially now that she is speaking in such support of Black Lives Matter, it is a bit hypocritical.
It feels hypocritical, yeah. So she also rejected calls, like you said, from civil rights groups to investigate the police shootings following the 2014 police-involved killing of Mike Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. In 2015, she did require body cameras for California Department of Justice agents, but she did not support legislation mandating them for all police officers,
right.
which you're like, why?
And she even brings that up in the video that I was saying that I watched this morning of the debate between Biden, Harris, and Gabbard. And that's what she says. She's like, I started the body cams in California, but there's that little, you know, you got to add an asterisk to that and say, but
that caveat.
You know, mm-hmm. there's something else to that. That's not the entire picture. So while that's good.
Right. It's not good enough.
Yeah.
It's not good enough.
And she was very unpopular with the citizens of San Francisco, where she was district attorney and attorney general. And there were even flyers that were being put out during this time that said, tell California Attorney General Kamala Harris to prosecute killer cops. It's her job.
Right. It feels very much like what we do now with Jackie Lacey, uh-huh. who is the district attorney here in Los Angeles,
yep.
where we, during the Black Lives Matter protests, there have been a ton of protests against her for the same reason, because she is not prosecuting cops.
Exactly.
And kind of along those lines, as DA, well, not along those lines, but whatever. As DA, she began prosecuting parents of habitually truant students, calling the issue of students skipping school, quote, tantamount to a crime. And she did this amid criticism that the policy disproportionately targeted low-income people of color, because of course it did.
Because of course it did.
Right.
Because the kids that are going to have the most difficult time getting to school are going to be the ones that probably cannot afford to get a ride from somebody else or have the support from, you know, family right. and financial services to help them get to school.
Right, which is something that she should know. And so this is why she became, you know, because she kind of did build this career off of being like, I'm a black woman. But then when the black community needed her, and they were very excited at first to have her on their side, it felt like she abandoned them.
Yeah.
And she was working for the white establishment rather than working for the people of color who got her elected.
And that's
you know?
The thing that makes me wonder how much of that was true to her morals, because she does appear to back everything that she's done, which I think you kind of like, you could admit that you'd been wrong, but I feel like most people will kind of stick by their guns and what they did and try to explain it away. And I kind of feel like that's what she's doing. But maybe those things that she did not line up morally with who she was. I don't know. Or she's changed.
I think it can be a catch-22 for politicians, because if you change your mind, very often you're called a flip-flopper, where it's just normal
yeah.
to change your mind whenever you're presented with new information. I am hoping that she is absolutely going to be forced to address these things. And I'm hoping that she is able to admit the places where she messed up and pledge to do better. But that same year that she was doing all the truancy stuff, in 2010, she opposed an initiative in the state to legalize marijuana. And she does now support the legalization of marijuana. Right. However, during her tenure as attorney general, at least 1,560 people were thrown behind bars for marijuana-related offenses between 2011 and 2016.
Yeah.
And that's from the Washington Free Beacon. So
and
she has to release those people.
She does. And she was once asked during that time if she ever smoked weed, and she laughed. Like, it's just so cruel.
It is because, you know, there are people all across this country who are spending long periods of time in federal prison for nonviolent marijuana-related offenses, and now you have politicians coming out supporting the legalization, decriminalization of it. Those people need to be released. Kamala Harris has a responsibility to release those people, especially once again knowing that those convictions disproportionately, greatly affect Black and Brown communities,
right,
of which she claims with pride to be a member. So you have to, to me, that's one of the biggest ones where I'm like, you have got to release these people.
Right, exactly.
I know we're running long, but I just wanted to kind of give the flip side of why people kind of want to give Kamala Harris some slack.
Yeah.
So in 2004, she was an opponent of the death penalty, and there had been a death penalty case in which a gang member shot and killed a police officer. And she was getting a lot of pressure to execute this person, to bring back the death penalty in order to execute this person who had shot and killed this police officer. She refused to do so, and this did not sit well with police officials. So this is kind of in the beginning of her career. This is before she's attorney general. This is when she's a DA. And because of that, it actually almost ruined her career.
Yeah.
She almost did not get reelected because of this. And so because of that, she became harder on crime. Because like I said, as a Black woman, as a Black person, anytime you looked like you were on the side of a gang member and not the police.
Right. It's not going to turn out well for you.
Criticized. So this is another quote from that Atlantic article. This was the context in which Harris entered politics. By the standards of the early 2000s, her opposition to the death penalty made her a progressive on criminal justice issues, and that progressivism almost ended her political career. She responded by largely avoiding confrontations with police, a wariness she has now jettisoned as the public has grown more critical of police violence. So
that puts it into a great perspective.
Right. She didn't do the right thing back then, but I don't think she did the right thing because she was trying to preserve her political career. And we can argue whether or not that's right,
yeah,
for her to have done that. But I think she did what she felt like she had to do, whether that was right or wrong.
Right. So the person that Kamala obviously is going to be working with is our hopefully future president, Joe Biden, who, you know, if I were to get into the crime bill, it would be a whole other episode. So I'm just going to touch briefly on where it kind of ties into the election today and the whole Black Lives Matter movement we have going on and our want to defund the police. It's upsetting because in 1994, this was the largest crime bill in U.S. history. It provided 100,000 new police officers, and they had a $9.3 billion budget in funding for prevention programs and also for more jails and prisons. So if there are going to be more jails and prisons, that means that there are more people that have to go into these jails and prisons. So there were longer sentences, there were harsher sentences being put out, and again, disproportionately affected the Black community and mm-hmm. and you know, any other, and it affected all people of color more than it did anybody else. And so if we look at Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, we see that they're both heavily responsible for so many incarcerations and harsher prison sentences. And, you know, they kind of, to me right now, represent a lot of what's wrong in our justice system and the things that we're fighting against, which is really frustrating. So I went onto Politico.com and just looked at all of their policies. And I even compared them a little bit to Bernie and Elizabeth Warren, because those were our favorites. But of course, we're going to focus on Joe Biden and Kamala Harris right now. And the few that I wanted to bring up is that they do seem to be very progressive when it comes to gun control. They support voluntary buyback programs and favor universal background checks and a national firearm registry, which also falls in line with Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren's viewpoints, which is great. An unfortunate thing for women is that he still wants to have some limits on abortion, and Kamala feels the same. Kamala is a huge advocate for women's rights and reproductive rights and things like that. So again, I feel like she's pandering a little bit to being more moderate.
She's compromising.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She wants there to be, you know, less restrictions and things like that. But Joe Biden says, and he's also fairly progressive with it as well. As long as everything falls in line with Roe versus Wade.
He was not. His stance on abortion, because also Joe Biden is Catholic, which is something that I didn't know.
Yeah.
His stance on abortion in the 70s was really, like, he did not agree with Roe v. Wade.
Oh,
and in fact, even after the rape and incest exemptions passed, where we're like, you can't have abortion unless you've been raped or you're a victim of incest, he voted to remove those exemptions.
Yeah.
So throughout his career, his record on abortion
it's not great. But I went on the Planned Parenthood website, and they very openly endorse Joe Biden, and they say that he is, you know, a champion for some of these causes. So he does. I wouldn't call him a champion, but he does, you know, believe that there should be some limits. And then when I looked at Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren's, they said few limits, if any. So that's kind of seeing the difference. Like, Biden, I feel like, is going to kind of keep with the status quo of what our abortion laws have been, pretty much, where I think Bernie and Elizabeth Warren wanted to make our reproductive rights improved.
More accessible,
yeah,
for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also, Joe Biden opposes Medicare for All, which is really unfortunate.
Wild during a pandemic that he would feel that way, but okay.
Both Kamala Harris and Joe Biden Kamala Harris believes in legalizing marijuana, but Joe Biden wants to let the states decide. And they both say that they want to scrap past pot convictions. So I'm like, Kamala, where are you at?
Chop,
that
chop.
Would be great. There was some troubling thing with defense spending that I could get into on another day. But that's something, you know, whenever we're discussing, you know, defense and militarizing, you know, the police and anything like that, seeing that that is going to be funded right now is kind of unfortunate. He does want to raise corporate income taxes and wealth taxes. Joe Biden says, don't worry so much about China, which made me laugh. So for the most part, it seems like the biggest thing that we are going to have to kind of keep our candidates on task with when they get the presidency and the vice presidency, let's be optimistic, our biggest things that we are probably going to have to look out for is how they handle law enforcement post George Floyd, you know?
Yes. Because these two, I feel like, are politicians, they can read the room of what's happening right now. And I hope that that means that they will be making changes that are positive. In that way,
yeah.
I do have hope that that will be the case.
And I'm always hoping that whoever is going to be in their administration, whoever is surrounding them in their day-to-day life, I think that's also a really important factor into what politicians decide, because it's not just them. You know, they get advice from so many people, and ensuring that they're going to be around people that are also very progressive and educate them and push them forward to make these changes, I think is going to be the most helpful.
Right. Well, and kind of my final thoughts on these two, I do think maybe later on we can do like an extended mini episode where we kind of just talk about their stance on all the major issues, because we weren't able to get to that today. But my kind of final thoughts on these two candidates is I actually went in, you know, I went into this feeling hopeful for Kamala, but also very, very critical. And I remain critical of her. However, I feel like Kamala knows the right thing to do. And I think once she has the ability to do the right thing, I think that she actually will do it. I think in her heart, she is not a bad person. I think she did bad things.
I agree.
In order to gain power, which is not good. Don't get me wrong.
I have to say this episode was eye-opening in both ways, to the positives and to the negatives of these people. And yes, it did make me as well feel a little bit better about Kamala Harris, made me feel worse about Joe Biden.
But at the same time, we've already survived
Biden in office in some way. So,
right. And at the same time, even though a lot that I read about Joe Biden, I didn't like, I did read some things that I did like.
Yeah.
And I did read a lot of his stances on major issues and what he wants to do in the presidency. And overall, I think it's good.
Yeah.
I do think it's good. I don't think while a lot of things that he's done in his past, I disagree with mostly. Just the lying, Joe.
Yeah.
Like, if you had just not lied so much. Mostly that stuff. But other than that, I really do feel like they both have good intentions to make the kind of improvements that we want to see.
Like, yeah. I hope that they have the country's best interests at heart.
Right. And I did post something on Instagram that was saying that, you know, you're not looking for the one when you go to vote. It's not dating. It's not marriage. You're not looking for the one. It's public transport. You're getting on the bus that's taking you closest to where you want to
exactly.
go.
Exactly.
So while these two candidates are not perfect, are they taking us? That's the question we need to ask ourselves. Are they taking us closer in the direction that we want to go than where we are currently?
100%.
And to me, the answer is absolutely.
Obviously.
You know?
Obviously. Yeah. Yeah. Anything would be better than this dumpster fire we've had for the last 3.5 years. So, oh, well, this was a doozy. I'm going to have fun editing this one.
I mean, and we even tried to go fast, I could tell.
We totally
it
did.
Was just a lot. It was a lot of information. There was just no way around it.
Yeah, I just we were thinking of maybe doing it in two parts and all this stuff. And I was like, no, I really want to just try to get it out there. And obviously, there's going to be more discussions of this to come. And, you know, I'm sure Keegan as well would really love to hear all of your thoughts on all of this. What are your thoughts on these candidates? And do you feel hopeful? Do you feel discouraged? What are your thoughts and feelings? Because I really learned a lot through, you know, just exploring their past and things like that. And I kind of want to know what you all are thinking now. So if you want to...
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. If you want to send us a message...
I was going to say, we also realized that we didn't hit on everything.
Yeah.
Like, there's a bunch of positive shit in Biden's past as well that we didn't talk about today. So we will be bringing up that stuff as time goes on.
Yeah.
We just didn't have time.
It would have been like a 5-parter. We would have had to have like an episode on each like major topic, and it would have been too much. So we just wanted to give you a quick overview. But if there's anything that you do want to say to us, reach out to us about, go ahead and email us at neighborhoodfeminist@gmail.com. You can direct message and follow us on Instagram. I like had another thought in my head and then I forgot what our Instagram was.
Angry Neighborhood Feminist.
I know
Feminist.
What it is now, but as I was saying it, it wasn't coming out. At Angry Neighborhood Feminist. We have a Twitter that we sometimes use at YAMF Podcast. YANF Podcast. We have a Facebook business and group page. Go ahead and rate and review us on the business page and chat with the other listeners on the group page. You can also rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate it so much when you do that. And we also really appreciate it when you listen to us on the Radio Public app. It is a free way for you to listen to us, and it helps us just a teeny tiny bit. With all that being said, we encourage you to rage on.
Bye.
Bye.